James Carter plays all sorts of saxophones, big ones, small ones, soprano, alto, and the deep, almost unheard of bass saxophone. And these instruments don't just have voices, they have personalities. You know, I just heard you call, you said, I hope this girl doesn't act up. Is that how you talk, is that how you refer to your saxophone, this girl?
Well, this one in particular, it's, well, we call it a girl anyway. It's, it's this Buddy Tate's old saxophone. I call it Lady Tate, actually.
Now, how do you determine the sex of the saxophone? Does it have to do with the voice?
It lets you know.
I see, I'm afraid that what you really want to say is, oh, well, they're temperamental. The temperamental ones, I call them she.
Well, no, not to a general extent, no. It might have something geographically to do with it as well, like all the French saxophones you think of is nice and delicate, and then the German and American ones, and those where you think of, you know, that craftsmanship, just got to be in tune, I guess.
The 32-year-old James Carter has made a name for himself playing many different jazz styles, but he spent the past year concentrating on what's called hot jazz. James Carter's most recent CD, Chasin' the Gypsy, pays homage to the hot jazz scene of Paris in the 1930s and 40s. This past week, Carter and other musicians from around the world played in the second annual celebration of gypsy guitarist Django Reinhardt, who died in 1953.
I think the first time, I know the first time that I actually heard it, but not through a conscious effort, was through public radio, actually, in my hometown, Detroit, Michigan. It was a program that was available at this time, we're looking at the early 80s, called Jazz Yesterday, which was hosted by Jim Gallard. And I would record his show from time to time on either a 60 or 90 minute tape. If it was a 60 minute tape, I would just go ahead and record the music, and there would be some times where Jim Gallard would just talk. And I would, of course, omit that due to not having that much tape, because music would be the most important thing. You know?
That particular day, though, Carter forgot to stop the tape and didn't delete the commentary about the musicians. That's how he found out that the swinging jazz he heard was made by Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli. Reinhardt learned to play the violin and the banjo when he was very small, but it was the guitar that made him famous. When he was 18, he was burned in a fire, and his left hand was so badly damaged he could only use two fingers for fretting chords. But that didn't stop him from becoming a dazzlingly fast guitar player with a deeply expressive style. What grabbed you about this style of music?
It was just all ear catching and just grabbing, you know. Couldn't just help but to be sucked in, or, you know, to become a part of it. And there was no amplification whatsoever. It was just music that was straight into one overhead microphone. And it's like, man, and the power that you got from it was strictly from these instruments, as opposed to, you know, the boards twiddling the knobs or anything of that sort, you know. He had that passion, that drive, and it seems like he was not only able to do that with his own compositions, but he was also able to do that with the various takes that he did off of classical compositions, such as he did things off of Tchaikovsky's music, he did some Russian melodies, and made very swinging medleys out of them. I mean, he reworked them and made them fit his own, you know, person. It was a different suit by the time he got done with them.
And that's exactly what Carter has done with his renditions of Reinhardt's compositions. In Nuage, for example, the violin becomes a bass saxophone with a big, deep voice.
Nuage was originally a tenor piece. It originally started out on clarinet, and then I wound up playing it on soprano, then I wound up playing it on tenor, and never considered bass saxophone up until the point I got into the studio. I had it in my hand, and I said, let me give this a try.
I want to ask you about this song called Heavy Artillery, because it's got that name, which would imply one thing, but it's anything but heavy. Let's listen to a little bit of it. There's a real playful quality to it.
I get the sassiness out of it, too, but that's what he called it, and it was after the war, and I guess there was still certain associations with artillery shells and I guess packing, and you know, somebody in the infantry, you know, going up and down in trenches and all that other good, you know, stuff that was going on with the trials and tribulations of war at that time. And this might have been a way to talk about it.
You called this album Chasing the Gypsy. What do you mean by that?
The chasing the gypsy aspect doesn't necessarily mean like one particular figure. That's why I always kept saying that this wasn't a Django Reinhardt tribute, just using the exact personnel that he used and just superimposing myself on top of that. I mean, anybody can do that. It's almost like a dish over rice, pretty much, you know. But being able to sit down and rework and to not necessarily let the music die, quote unquote, by keeping it in that same suit of clothes that we talked about, and, you know, making it a relic in that sense. It can always be a rejuvenation process, and it always is.
Well, James Carter, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Likewise.
James Carter. His latest album is Chasing the Gypsy. The Django Reinhardt Festival concludes tonight in New York City.
Thank you.
This is NPR, National Public Radio. The fighting in Afghanistan and the fear of terrorism here in the U.S. risk overshadowing some of the world's other pressing concerns. Today is World AIDS Day. Since last December 1st, 3 million more people have died of AIDS and 5 million have been infected with HIV. Earlier this year, Kofi Annan, the United Nations Secretary General, proposed a $10 billion global fund to fight AIDS. Many skeptics predicted Annan's global AIDS fund would get bogged down in international politics. But as NPR's Richard Knox reports, the critics may be in for a surprise.
Skeptics have been pessimistic from the start about the Global AIDS Fund. It'll never get off the ground, they say, because of endless fights on how to structure it. Detractors predict if the fund does survive birth, it'll grow up to be just another UN boondoggle. Some worry it'll soak up money from other diseases, so early on its mission got stretched to cover tuberculosis and malaria. Even veteran AIDS activists are wary of Annan's fund. Sandy Thurman was the AIDS czar in the Clinton White House. She now heads a group called the International AIDS Trust.
We don't need to be funding more bureaucracy. We're strangled to death with it in this epidemic and have been since the very beginning in the United States and around the world.
Few expected the Bush administration to be a champion for the AIDS fund. Last May, President Bush seemed to confirm this by pledging no more support than has been offered by Italy, the UK, and financially strapped Japan. But support for the fund has grown quietly within the administration. Here's what Secretary of State Colin Powell says about it in his World AIDS Day message.
I am proud that my country is playing a leading role in creating a new global fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. President Bush has pledged $200 million in seed money for the fund. More will follow.
How much more? To be determined, says one administration official. But AIDS activists claim that, in private, officials are saying as much as $700 million more may be available in the coming year. That's still a far cry from the $7 to $10 billion Annan wants. But for now, the most significant thing is the surprising agreement on the Global Fund's ground rules that's developed lately between the U.S. government and the most militant AIDS activists. Negotiations in Brussels last week produced what one activist called a somewhat astonishing victory on one of the most contentious issues, getting AIDS treatment as soon as possible to people in the poorest countries. Paul Davis of the Health Gap Coalition says the group's concept is called Quick Start.
What was created was a working group around Quick Start, which is a way to start delivering these rapid results. We hope that the U.S. delegation will push very hard to get pills into the hands of people with AIDS.
The idea is not to wait for each country to go through internal debate on what programs to fund. Quick Start would invite existing non-governmental groups to apply for support directly. Advocates say money from the Global Fund could start to flow as early as April.
There is a great deal of existing infrastructure. There are mission hospital systems that have well-trained doctors. There are dozens of community-based clinics that provide treatment to hundreds of people and simply have empty cupboards and empty pharmacy. Some large industrial concerns have clinics that treat tens of thousands of workers, but they don't have antiretroviral medicine.
Activists argue that if the Global Fund doesn't produce dramatic and measurable results from AIDS treatment in the first year, it won't attract the billions of dollars it needs to stay in business. The Bush administration agrees. Dr. Jack Chow of the State Department heads the U.S. delegation.
The Quick Start aim is to have the fund in its entirety up and running. So I think it's very important that we show success early and frequently enough to prove that the design of the Global Fund is working and that the money goes to the people who need it.
Those who need it, activists say, are grassroots groups in poor countries which are already struggling to deliver health services. U.S. negotiators are confident the remaining issues around the fund will be worked out this month at a final session in Brussels, and that the Global AIDS and Health Fund will be up and running in January, right on schedule. Richard Knox, NPR News.